Matt, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Matt, I hope that the piece that you put together, and you've written on this topic several times, and the computer wagering groups, as they're referred to, you hear them called, you know, the computer, you know, CAW groups, CRWs, the groups, quote unquote, and the two pick sixes that one at Pleasanton and the one at Del Mar that were taken down by what appeared to be CAW, that has triggered, you know, another examination, as you say. Jackpot payouts put spotlight on computer-assisted wagering programs, and I thought this was a good opportunity to kind of revisit the topic and provide everybody with a little bit more of the background of this debate, discussion, and awareness.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be a topic that we have to revisit, you know, at least once every couple years, you know. And I think it's one of those topics that isn't well understood. It's not something, as I touch on in the article, it's not something that racetracks generally advertise or talk about, including in a pool in which CAWs aren't allowed. It's I know Andy Sterling at NYRA mentions it, you know, during some of his broadcasts, but it's not something that NYRA puts on promotional materials or anything like that. And especially when you have, you know, generations of horse players that start to play the game. I know everyone is probably scoffing out there and saying, which new players? Well, the game does generate new players. And those people especially might not know what's going on in these pools. And so I think, you know, every once in a while we do need to acknowledge that these programs are out there, explain how they work, explain what the controversy is surrounding them, and then also the significance they have for the racing industry as far as its business.
I've had this discussion with you. You mentioned Andy. Have had Maury Wolf on this topic. Paul Matisse, Frank Angst has covered it extensively. And Maury is probably the oracle when it comes to this topic. And he had been in some cases, you know, the Cassandra trying to tell the industry in 2000, 20 years ago, that this was going to become an issue, and that the industry as a whole was going to need to make a decision about how much of the total pool, the total handle in the game, they were willing to let these kinds of operations have. And that has gone, that debate really never seemed to happen externally anyway. And to this point right now, there's estimates of what, upwards of 27 to 30% of the handle annually is now CAW money.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of those back of the envelope estimates is probably pretty accurate. You know, going back 20 years ago, that is how long these programs have been in the pools. The idea that there's a limit on, or you could limit the amount of activity that these programs do have in the pools, they bump up against a theoretical limit in which they get diminishing returns anyway. So when they start getting up to 30-35% of the pool, then they're reaching that limit in which they don't have a net profit expectation. So there is actually kind of a natural limit on how much the program can participate in these pools. So I think that's one of those things. You know, going back 20 years ago, the argument was, okay, whether or not this made sense for the racing industry to take this money, considering the advantages these guys would have in the pools and the amount of the rebates that they would need to make these programs go. Even when Bill Benter started his, you know, in the late 1990s in Hong Kong, and also was dipping into the U.S. pools, they needed rebates back then, and the discussion mostly was focused on rebates. And I think, as someone who had a personal opinion about rebates back then, I lost my argument. The rebates are not going away. They are part of the industry now. They've been there for 20 years. Most players do get them. And now I think the discussion is shifting to, well, how much is too big of a rebate? I don't know how much is too big of a rebate. There's a sliding scale based on participation in the pools that every player is facing right now. And if we decided as an industry that rebates were appropriate, based on this sliding scale, like a frequent flyer program, I'm not sure how you modify that or change that to reflect more fairness in the pool when you've introduced something already that puts people on unequal footing.
A couple of things out of that. I don't think anybody is unwilling to acknowledge what essentially is a volume discount, that's a standard business practice, and even small level players that aren't six figure players, even they are getting some forms of rebate, even if it's modest, even if it's free PPs and other betting information and, you know, other support from their ADW, everybody is getting something back. And if you aren't, all you have to do is ask and reach out to customer service with whoever you're betting with, and they'll point you in the direction. Even if it's points and some free tchotchkes, you can get something no matter what size of a player you are. The concerns, Matt, that haven't really been fleshed out. I don't care about the rebate because that's out there for everybody. What is troubling is the understanding that these groups are literally plugged into the pools electronically, and they are getting information in real time where their computer is then interacting with that information, and that's a competitive advantage that isn't available to others. And that seems to be the topic that isn't getting discussed the way it should.
Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on that topic as far as what these computer programs have access to as far as the pools. We do know that they generate their own line. They generate their own will pays. And, you know, according to every person who's in charge of either monitoring the wagering pools or is in charge of mutual pools at a racetrack, they are not seeing ticket detail. I know that this is one of those things that lives on in the internet. They are not seeing ticket detail. They are not seeing what combinations have not been covered. And the simple way to know that is that if that were the case, then there would never, ever be a pool that didn't get hit, especially in these 20-cent pools. There would never, ever be a carryover. So I think there is some misunderstanding on that. You have to, you know, understand that these computers are using algorithms that now have been in place that are tweaked continually and then also get better and more efficient for a decade in some cases. They're highly efficient. They're very good at projecting what odds are going to be. They're very good at determining what their net payout is going to be based on whether or not you hit this combination or not. These are very sophisticated programs. They are akin to high-frequency trading programs that exist on Wall Street, that exist in the commodities markets. There is some misunderstanding out there, and I understand the paranoia that people have. I absolutely do. But they are not seeing ticket-level data.
Well, and that's helpful, and it's good to know that. At the same time, the ability for them to not have to extrapolate anything, not have, you know, the fact that they are literally getting the tote as it moves, it is creating you know, a variety of ripple effect negativity. And aside from, you know, paranoia and conspiracy theory lunacies, the one that is much more palpable has got to be the late odds changes and the adjustments, because they're, you know, they're the ones that are doing that. They're also sapping value out of the exotics, particularly the exactas, because they're reading the probables. The computer is reading the probables, and it's balancing the probables so that they can bet on a certain percentage of the combinations, and that's taking value. That's essentially a built-in takeout that the public isn't even aware of, essentially.
You know, I agree fundamentally with all of this. I really do, and I have agreed with it for two decades. You know, so the program is doing what I do when I bet, looking at probables. If the program says that an exacta, you know, should be paying $74, and instead it's paying $120 on the board, it's going to play that exacta until that probable gets to the $74. It's theoretical odds. It's weighted probability of that. So it's doing it much faster. It's doing it way more efficiently. It can reach farther into its pocket to cover more combinations. But at the same time, as someone who plays in the exact and trifecta pools a lot, it is doing what I want to do. You know what I mean? I just don't have a computer program to do it. And there will be, the computer players will say to you, well, why don't you just build a program and then you could do it? And I think that's where the casual fan or the person who is not a professional horse player, where that really rubs them wrong, because this is obviously doctorate level math. This is not something that anyone can do, nor are there advertisements on the internet to take a piece of one of these programs. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, this has been a problem for 20 years. The problem, you know, for me and for most casual players is that this argument was lost a long time ago. There are options out there. As far as if you're playing a lot of multi-legs, they're very few and far between. The computers don't play in the low takeout pools, or at least they don't play to any, you know, significant degree. And it is one of those things where the more you learn, the more you think your back is against the wall. And that is a problem. I just don't know how the industry addresses it at this point, after the barn door was closed a long time ago.
Well, and that's why I frequently, you know, and for years have referenced, and Maury discussed it, you know, openly years ago on the show, that, you know, this was only going to get worse, and that,
I remember, and I can't remember which track, I thought it was Gulfstream, and Andy Beyer came up to me, and it was a dot matrix printout. If you remember those printers, and it was a stack of paper, and he said, "Matt, look at what this program just fed into this pool." And I was like, "This, you know, this was 20 years ago," and I was like, "This is amazing. You know, this is incredible." I didn't know the depth that these programs operated at, and like I said, that was 20 years ago. It is a debate that the industry is going to continue to have. And then, like I said, I just don't know what the solutions or what the tweaks are going to be, where you are going to satisfy both the computer programs and the people in the industry who are aware of the activity.
Well, you folded in your piece, and you know, the word actually did originally kind of emanate from here, from the show, that NYRA was excluding the groups from the late pick five, and it did it consciously. you know, is, you know, there's also anecdotally Peter Berube and Tampa and also Oaklawn limiting access. I mean, is there potential for a marketing advantage for racetracks to speak up and say, you know, CAW excluded pool here?
Yeah, I mean, you could. I'm sorry, my call waiting is beeping, and I can't stand that it just beeps into my ear the whole time while I'm on the phone. Is there a marketing opportunity? I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, Oaklawn has advertised this before. When Charlie Hayward was at NYRA, he wanted to have pools that didn't have CAWs in it. It's the idea that that late pick five and the cross country pick five is kind of a holdover from that. Maybe there is a marketing opportunity, but at the same time, most players say that they really want liquidity in the pools. The computer programs, for all the criticism of them, certainly create liquidity. When you have these low takeout pick fives at some of these other tracks, they don't get close to the amount of handle that the higher takeout pick fives do that allow CAWs into the pool. So there are trade-offs in every decision you make. And so that's why I think this is a very difficult issue, because there isn't a black and white answer that can steer people to a better path forward.
One of the things that came out of, and you addressed it, Jay Privman in his overnight reporting regarding the situation at Del Mar, was this sliding scale of volume, which really, I thought, Matt, was a valuable snapshot to help people understand what these operations are doing, because the realization that there was a $30 increment, there was a combination probably of all favorites that was played for $30 by the groups in this group that hit the Del Mar pick six, and then it slid down from there, $24, $22, $20, $18, $16, all the way down to the combination that hit with an $8 increment. And what was amazing, I thought, and you know, really kind of shows, you know, peek behind the curtain, was the fact that only 1% of all of their combinations had that $100 winner, that $114 winner that Tim McKenna sent out. And it gives you an indication of, you know, if there is, you know, the, you know, when the Derby futures come out and there's those charts, the PDF of the 20 by 20 or 24 by 24, and you see the graph of, you know, looking across and looking down, and it that's the kind of thing you envision. You see the combinations, you can visualize how many were, you know, how many are covered. And it just shows you the way in which this thing, this monolith essentially, is attacking the pools. And it's intimidating.
Yeah, I had, you know, a conversation with Pat Cummings, who's very, you know, smart guy, runs the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation. And, you know, my question was, because when this got hit, I didn't just, probably because I know so much about the pool, it's my job, you know, it's my job to know. I didn't think this was that unusual. And it was his opinion, the people that he talks to, and he has a wagering committee, is that the idea that there were computers in the multi-leg pools that were playing at higher denominations, that was a surprise to those players, that they thought, because they had been told forever, hey, cover as many combinations as possible, don't worry about hitting for multiples, just cover as many as you can under your bankroll, that this was surprising to them. Now, at the same time, all kinds of exacta and trifecta bettors do this exact same thing. There is one combination for me in an exact or trifecta pool that is going to get me my best result. And those are bet at multiple a much higher denomination than the minimum wager. So this is not a new strategy, nor is it a unique strategy, but I don't think that players understood that the computer programs were doing it in the multi-leg pools. I think that's where the outcry, had its genesis was in that. So,
do we know how many groups are operating? I mean, is there? You know, we hear certain names, Elite and there's Don Johnson's group that is out there. I mean, how many are doing this?
You know, normally when I have a discussion with someone about it, the number hovers between 6 and 12. I have no idea if that is correct. It's a very hard issue to get accurate numbers on. You have to remember some of these guys don't churn a profit and they drop out. They try it or their mathematical model isn't good enough, and so they have to tweak the model and bow out of the pools. And other guys might come in. So it's very difficult to get a handle on. And it's one of those things where there is probably knowledge somewhere in the industry of the exact number and the exact amount of handle, but it's not a number that people are willing to discuss openly.
When it comes to, you referenced the low takeout pick five approach, and we know what Naira's doing, and I've been featuring Indiana Grand and Canterbury extensively, and certainly, even with their pick five, somewhere typically between 50 and 90,000 each day, the return has been spectacular. I mean, they've been outpaying the parlay, one after the other, and even when it chalks out, people are getting.
If people accept that you're not going to pay off your house in a pick five pool, then you can play those pools. I think the expectation is that people look at the $50,000 pool and go, well, since I can't make $120,000, I'll go elsewhere. But you're absolutely right about those smaller pools. There should be more smaller players just targeting those. I know when you look at the pool total, you say to yourself, well, this isn't going to let me retire, but was that your purpose anyway? These are playable pools.
Well, and just this week already, we've had at Canterbury, we've had two three-winner pools of 25,000 and 15,000. This has been a regular, a completely standard since both of their seasons started. They're both doing big business, and let's actually morph into that too. Matt Hegarty with us from the Form, and Matt, the biggest success story out of pandemic racing, that would be a good name for a new partnership group, Pandemic Racing.
Punk band.
Yeah, there you go. The Monday through Thursday calendar. I mean, yesterday, for instance, I saw where Finger Lakes did another $1 million day. $1.4 million at Canterbury yesterday, $2.2 million at Indiana. Talk a little bit from what you've been monitoring. You reported on the most recent quarterly handle release. Chris Rossi, O Crunk on Twitter. Chris is constantly keeping everybody informed, as to the various handle figs. What's your feel on what we've seen here over these last 4.5-5 months? Because it sure feels like there is some incremental new business, and I also feel there's been a habit and practice shift to people that have been playing earlier in the week.
Yeah, well, right before I came on, the July figures came out, and the gross wagering on U.S. races was $1.1 billion compared to $942 million last year, even though there were 500 less races held. This is a gross number. This is gross growth. We haven't seen that yet during the pandemic. I have been very reluctant to comment on anything regarding what this means to the business, just because there are far too many variables in play right now. But when you see the total gross handle go up, and there are obviously some things, what about Keeneland holding, five race days in July when they didn't last year? Well, that accounts for $63 million of the 156, but then Del Mar had to cancel a whole weekend. So it doesn't matter. Once you put all those what-ifs in, you're still talking about a gross increase in total thoroughbred handle. It's getting clearer, I think, that there is organic growth in the racing industry. You wouldn't see these numbers without it, unless it's people that have completely, that were sports players and horse players before, who have completely shifted their bankrolls entirely to horse racing. But, anecdotally, I do know people who are playing, a lot more often. And we talked about this the last time I was on. The racetracks now looking at the racing calendar and saying, our market is elsewhere. Our market is not these people on the apron. Our market is the United States. And filling in these gaps in the calendar, this may be, and like I said, we talked exactly about this subject last time, that this is going to be one of the things we'll have to watch with, if and when we ever get out of this, that may have a lasting impact on the racing industry, that people are now looking at the calendar and saying, my job is not to get as much people on the apron, it's to get as much people looking at my signal as possible.
On that topic, it hasn't necessarily been appreciated widely what a remarkable job the racing. There's been hiccups, obviously. I mean, there was the Del Mar weekend, the lost weekend with a certain percentage of positives among jocks. There's some hardship being, that's obviously going to be forced on some people, including whatever format the jockey protocols takes when Churchill makes their decision and announces it. But for the most part, Matt, the industry has really figured this out in short order and is operating at what percent capacity do you think the business is operating right now?
As far as if you look at race days and number of races held, if you want to use that as a metric for operating capacity, then it's, about 80%, I guess. Looking here, race days was 398 to 484, so yeah, that's right around 80% of capacity of last year, but you've had a lot of calendar shifts. You can't ignore what's happening in the broader economy, the broader sporting world. If you were to come up with a term, 80% operating capacity would probably be about correct, I guess.
Well, that certainly puts, I would think, that puts the industry in a, in a solid position, vis-a-vis, America at large.
Yeah. There are obviously more sports have started. I mean, the NBA, the NHL, the golf has obviously started a while ago. We don't know what the impact of that is going to be, but we don't know what the impact of those sports being gone was either. I mean, I know it's easy to say, well, obviously racing must have drawn some eyeballs on that, and certainly there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that, but there are a lot of people that are still jobless. There are a lot of people that were jobless that were getting larger, unemployment payments than they normally would. There are a lot of people that took pay cuts and still have them. It's so hard to come to any conclusion right now, and I think it will be very hard for anyone to come to a conclusion after this is over. There are just too many variables.
Well, that's exactly, you know, the scenario as you know, it is existing right now. It's going to be very difficult, I would imagine, to draw conclusions, and also, Matt, to make decisions going forward off of, you know, some of the things that have happened. And even from that standard, I think there's been some really good decisions. I mean, Eric Hallstrom and with Indiana, and certainly Canterbury, adjusting their schedules. It seems like it's paying off, and so people on the fly are doing what they think might be best for their business interests, and certainly nice to see them get rewarded.
Yeah, and you know, there's going to be a bigger realization just with this rescheduling on different dates where the tracks can have, you know, a much greater market presence just because they're one of only a few operating. And if you remember, during the Keeneland meet, there was a lightning delay, I think, and their director of mutuals, who's one of the good guys in racing, actually tweeted out, "We've had a lightning delay, and we're going to go off at this time. And the reason we're going to go off at this time is because we don't want to have racing at the same time that NYRA is." And there's an acknowledgement in the racing industry that you got to keep post times off each other, especially for the marquee signals. That is a realization that has been a long time coming. Hopefully coming out of this, more racetracks are far more cognizant of the benefits to being alone up there for 10 minutes, 12 minutes, things like that. So I do think that will be something we'll have to explore when things get a little back to normal, as far as how permanent some of these shifts are going to be.
Well, and that is a topic, of course, you've covered, and when we think back to the Jockey Club Roundtable reporting of the McKinsey, the second McKinsey study, there was the program from the Jockey Club, right? The Jockey Club Information Systems, they had the tool for tracks to use in terms of doing a better job. I think the number, Matt, as I recall from McKinsey, was a 7% handle boost was possible with better coordination of post times.
Yeah, and that's right into the racing office software now, so that if you punch in your post times, it generates a flag that says, okay, you do know that your post time is 1 minute before this other track that draws the exact same customers as you. So, there is an automated function now in the racing office software. So that's always good. And there's no drawback to it. That's the thing. Like, all you got to do is be work just a little harder, and you can get, what is probably free money. We haven't seen any studies on this yet, but the projection was that there would be at least a statistically significant bump in handle if you could avoid these overlaps.
Right. Well, the conversation began, of course, about the CAW programs and their involvement, and we wanted to fold a couple of other elements in. Matt follows this very closely, and has been discussing it, for a long time. And there are marketing opportunities. There's a few. You brought up Pat Cummings and TIF. One of the other marketing opportunities, in addition to excluding CAW money from certain pools at certain tracks, and also aggressively pricing your product in terms of takeout, and thereby more or less pushing them out just by virtue of it not having, not having room for them to receive the kind of rebates that they seek. The breakage topic, Matt, I've been amazed that nobody among the ADW companies has seized on the breakage potential as a marketing advantage and basically giving their customers the breakage benefit, and to me, that would be something.
Yeah, it depends on the jurisdiction, you know, where the breakage goes. Sometimes the breakage goes to the Racing Commission. Sometimes it goes to a retirement fund. You know, sometimes it goes to the horsemen. Sometimes the track and horsemen share it. So it's one of those things where there are so many entrenched interests that are receiving money from it already that it's very hard to peel it back. You know, this is not an industry that is whose margins are bursting at the seams. In fact, it's the contraction has certainly helped. I think tracks are probably in a better place than they were, you know, say, say 10 years ago. You know, there are already people who are receiving that money. So to give it to bettors, you have to take it away from those people. And that is always going to be a problem. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. So I think while you look at it and say, oh, this is simple, especially account wagering operations, right? Why aren't you just paying to the pay to the penny? It makes, you know, everything's electronic now. The only problem is, people are currently getting that money, so you have to take it away.
Well, do it for the players. Do the right thing.
Yep.
The Spike Lee says, do the right thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if doing the right thing was so easy, then it would be a better world. So.
Exactly. Matt, this was tremendous. I appreciate it, and we'll watch. I you're going to do a piece immediately on the July handle?
Yeah, that should be coming up soon. So,
Matt Hegarty, everybody, DRF Hegarty, covering the hard news like nobody else can, and does a tremendous job and a great service to DRF readers and our listeners. Matt, thanks.
Thank
Matt Hegarty, everybody. There he goes. And we'll stay right here. We've only got 15 minutes. And Seth Merrow is standing by. Seth is like, he's like that. Who's the meteorologist that's out there in tornadoes and stuff?
Roker?
No. I think they've retired him from...
Oh, the Weather Channel guy. Yes, the Weather Channel guy.
What's his name?
I don't know, but I know who you mean.
Yeah, you know, the guy that's like leaning in one direction as the you know as Margaret Hamilton flies by. What's that guy's name? Oh my gosh, it'll come to us. Well, Seth is out there with his recorder and his microphone, and he's on the spot at the Travers Draw, and you've got some Jim Cantore. Thank you. Dan Hart came up with Jim Cantore. Well done. And so did Eric, I think. I think Eric Hamelbeck, too. Thank you, guys. Seth, what was the draw? Give us the instant snapshot of the draw action.
Field of seven.
It's a field of eight.
Three.
It's a field of eight.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, field of eight. I had seven on the front. But yeah, field of eight. So I'm a great first.
Yeah.
The field size wrong right off the bat. Tis the one, the six, Uncle Chuck in the three. The one hole is the Orlando Noda long shot first line. I said earlier, there are no fans allowed on the track, but if the Noda horse is in the lead at the top of the stretch, you will know it no matter where you are in Saratoga, because the Noda team will be very vocal, as they are when their horses hit the lead in the stretch. But that, again, young guy who's having a great meet, so it'd be fun to see the first line at least run well. Country Grammar in the two, Caracaro in the seven. So, a field of eight, I don't know how important the post positions are, a mile and a quarter, but it was one of those where I talked a little bit to Linda Rice, a little bit to Barkley Tag, and you have to ask that question, the obligatory question coming into the first Saturday in May. Now it's Travers. You have to ask about the distance. And, yeah, nobody seemed too concerned about the mile and a quarter for their horse. But like typically coming into the Derby every year, it is going to be a question mark for some of these horses. I think, you know, Barkley, I think, kind of feels Tisdale off. It's fine. I had Jack Knowlton on with me this morning, and he was saying, and Barkley kind of reiterated it, he was hoping the Belmont would be the same mile and a half. So I don't think he's looking at a big obstacle at the mile and a quarter for Saturday. But again, it's a little bit different this year. It's the first time these guys will be going that trip.
Well, here's the quick rundown from 1 through 8 with the morning line. First line, the one hole, Davy Cohen, 30-1. The two, Country Grammar, 6-1 with Arat Ortiz for Chad Brown and Paul Pompa. Uncle Chuck, the three, 5-2. Luis Saez for Bob Baffert. Max Player, 6-1 from the four hole with Joel Rosario for Linda Rice. Then the five is Chivalry, Junior Alvarado for Ralph Nix and Fred Bry, 30-1 on Chivalry. Even money for Tiz the Law, Manny Franco, Barkley Tag, Sakatoga. The seven is Caracaro, 10-1, Gustavo Delgado, Javier Castellano, and the eight, South Bend, recently acquired now in the Bill Mott Barn. Jose Ortiz rides 15-1 for South Bend. Your field of eight for Travers 2020.
Yeah, South Bend off the close-up, second to Dean Martini in the Ohio Derby. Interested to see what that one can do, but obviously all eyes on Tiz the Law around here. I just want to add Jack on this morning. And he said the Sakatoga folks are going to be out. They have a ballroom at the Embassy Suites where most of the Sakatoga family and friends will be, and Jack and his limit of Sakatoga folks will be over for the race, obviously, later in the day, but they're planning a big day for the Tiz the Law crew. So, to me, he looks like the best three-year-old right now. I can't get by him. I think the horse that's the question mark and the contender for most people is probably going to be Uncle Chuck. But that said, Caracaro is interesting. Country Grammar coming off the Peter Pan win, interesting as well. But for me, as I say, Tiz the Law just seems like the clear leader in the three-year-old division at this point. And a win here, boy, you would have to think makes him kind of, I was going to say overwhelming favorite. I'm going to be interested to see how many horses go in this year's Kentucky Derby. You know, normally with a field of 20, even an overwhelming favorite winds up, you know, 2-1 or 5-2. But I'd be interested to see on the field size. And again, with a win, if it happens on Saturday, what kind of attention Tiz the Law does attract. But given what happened out in California on Saturday, it seems like a win Saturday for Tiz the Law puts him kind of firmly in the favoritism driver's seat, and you would think fairly short for the Kentucky Derby.
I will disagree. And for starters, I'm not convinced he's winning on Saturday.
And mine was contingent on if he wins, but I think he will.
Even if he wins, Art Collector has already established himself as you know, from a fig standpoint, is being faster. And the Art Collector on Sunday has a chance, I think, to wrangle favoritism in the Derby. He will be the now horse at that point. And frankly, anybody that's you know, fleeing the Honor AP bandwagon, there's room for others to get aboard, because I would not read anything into his loss on Saturday.
Yeah, I'm always in the ballpark if you don't make decisions on one race one way or the other. So I wouldn't, yeah, if I was on the bandwagon, I wouldn't flee, but it wasn't a bonus to run second. I mean, you know, given the short field and his favoritism in there, I don't know whether you still have the same level of confidence, but yeah, I wouldn't necessarily jump off the bandwagon had I been on.
No, but it does feel like right now, you know, with the result here and the potential for, I suppose, Max Player, Country Grammar, Uncle Chuck, and those are the three that the obvious major contenders to, you know, upset the Tiz the Law apple cart. South Bend, modestly intriguing as well. But beyond that, Art Collector, Honor AP, you know, I think we've got a pretty finite top shelf group, well separated from, you know, the next tier of Derby contenders.
And what, you know, as you talk to people over the past few weeks, are you getting a sense of what people feel the field size will be? Because I you know, given the whole change up this year, I have no feel, no guess. I mean, well, you know, you're looking at a field of at least 12, I would guess.
Oh my God! No, you're looking
normal 20.
you're going to be very close. Yeah, you'll be, if not 20, you'll be much closer to 20 than 12. Because right now, I mean, let's say the Derby, you know, and obviously Caracero needs some points, Uncle Chuck needs some points, and some of the other outsiders need points. However, Tis the Law is going, Authentic is going, Honor AP, NY Traffic, King Guillermo, Thousand Words, Dr. Post, Ette Indienne is, I mean, if he's healthy, he's going to go. Modernist, haven't heard anything new from Modernist. Country Grammar's already got 50 points. He's going to run. Enforceable's certainly going to run. Chivalry's got 40 points. Fred Bry's not going to not run unless, you know, the horse completely is up the track on Saturday. Max Player's going. Major Fed is going. Then you get into Storm the Court, Anno D'Or, Sol Volante. We haven't heard about this European Road to the Derby horse, whether he's coming or not, what is eligible. Finnick the Fierce, Pneumatic, Dean Martini would have to be supplemented, Field Pass, Shared Sense, Uncle Chuck, Candy Tycoon, Caracero. So how is this not 20? Plus, we just heard that Sid Fernando confirmed the speculation that Chuck Fipke would run Spite Sherrill if there's a room for him without any Derby points. So there's going to be 20 entered. I'll be shocked if there isn't.
I hope so. That bodes well for my all others ticket.
Ooh.
And, also, just to make it a juicy betting proposition every year with a feel bet. So I hope so. As I say, just have no feel. I think when you got down to kind of past 16 or so, to me it becomes a little more questionable, some of these horses. But I'm not disagreeing by any means. As I say, I just don't have a feel.
All right. You have a feel for some action today. We were a little late getting together. Of course, we were waiting for some scratches, and we're off the turf. First day of the meet that we've come off the turf. How about a couple of ideas from the Merrow train?
I do not have scratches, so you'll have to fill me in because I just got back to the set. A race that I'm looking forward to, and I went with the favorite, but I could play around in here easily, is that seventh race with some nice breeding. And I went with the sibling to Magnum Moon in there. Seventh race, I went 1.57 and 3, but I think the 4 from Pletcher is also interesting, so I could play around with that one. But the sibling to Magnum Moon, Black Magic Woman. Magnum Moon won the first 4 starts of his career, including in starts 3 and 4, the Rebel of the Arkansas Derby a couple of years ago. That said, this is a belated debut. This is a 3-year-old starting in August, so there's that question mark. But Harlem Heights is a sibling to Pine Island and Point of Entry. The seasonal debut indicated maybe this horse is improving as a 3-year-old, so I have that one in the mix. Heavenly Sis, I think, has to be considered in here. But Love on the Run, sibling to Belle Galante, who won the Belle Dame a few years ago. Second career start at 6-1 for Belmont. That one is interesting to me as well. So I use the morning line favorite, the sibling to Magnum Moon, but I think it's a fun race that one or two or three of these could come out of with a little bit of a future in front of them.
We've got, the ninth, for those that hadn't seen the scratches, the 1 and the 4 came out, so we've got a 4-horse field in that second level allowance, the 2, 3, 5, and 6 run, and then in the 10th, you had 4 horses come out of the 9, so it's a 5-horse field in the nightcap. So if you want to play the pick 4, pick 5 action, you probably, things trimmed up, pretty well. Take a look in the 8th. Take a look at Zoomer. You get the 7-pound bug from Cardenas for Bob Claseris, and might be a nice number in there.
That 8th race I had labeled as tough as you can, as competitive as you can get. I would have a. I in fact, we were on the air, and I looked up and. The wrong picks were listed for me on the chicklets, and I realized I had changed my picks like 3 times after, and I hadn't changed the picks before I sent them in. But that's how confused I was about this race. I never kind of fool around like that, but I had changed this one up a couple of times. and a couple of times after sending in the picks, and I wound up with Winston's chance at 8-1.
Well, and I'm just now, I was concentrating on the turf races, but I do see that actually Zoomer ended up scratching. Claseris came out of the race, so no good there. So we're going to have to reevaluate a little bit, and I'll have Nick Tamaro's analysis is up now at the website for everybody. You do have the stake, the Summer Colony. What did you do in the sixth, that second level allowance?
I had to use I Love Jackson. I mean, I just think he has an edge on the group. And control group and Duke's point, I'm kind of master of the obvious there. Playwright could be interesting off the claim for Linda Rice if you're fooling around and looking for a little bit of an alternative.
I Love Jackson came out.
Ah, okay. Well, then that changes that race up a little bit. Control group, Orlando Noda, who I mentioned earlier, having a really nice meet. I had him on the show a week and a half or so ago. He said his goal was going to be 6 wins. Yeah, he's two-thirds of the way there with two-thirds of the meet left. And I kind of like the confident move up off the claim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's quite... I don't know what to make of the Noda... the Noda board lightings. Interesting. I'm going to have to look at this again. I may just lay low, frankly, today. As it turns out, I was going to slap up some stuff.
I will say, during the handicapping show this morning, I said it's going to be a nice barometer of this new drainage system after the rain we took yesterday to see how soon Fast comes up on the board. It's up already. The track is already labeled Fast.
Yep. That's what everybody this morning. First, one of the first things we started to see was praise for the fast draining main track. It's tremendous, tremendous. Seth, I appreciate the live look in, and good luck today. We'll be
same
together.
Same to you. Same to everybody out there.
I appreciate it, Seth Merrow. Everybody, Capital OTB TV, and want to thank Matt Hegarty and Matt. Matt's visit, outstanding. Sid Fernando, Vince DiPaolo early this morning to go over his success in the Whitney Challenge. His $50,000 day at the races, sort of a version of Andy Byer's book. Sally Goodall, who we thought was going to join us today, is going to join us tomorrow instead in hour one. We'll talk to one of the greats on the contest front. And your first half tour leader. Good luck today, everybody. Very good Wednesday of racing. And we'll be together in the morning. Good luck.